You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Yeah, well, good question. So we started work on this project in the early to mid 1990s. It was a time when actually the Prime Minister at the time declared there was no poverty in New Zealand and conjured up the image of a sort of African starving child to support that view. So a number of us thought, well, we need to think about the use of language here, because there was certainly poverty. Added to that, a whole bunch of government agencies, police, fire, ambulance, hospitals, etc., wanted a tool to help them identify areas of highest need so they could direct resources into those areas, people with the highest need. And they didn't have an easy-to-use tool at that point to do that. And also communities wanted a tool for advocacy to help them attract resources into low-income communities. So that's what led to, those were the motivations for producing the New Zealand NZDEP, New Zealand Index of Socioeconomic Deprivation, that fulfills three functions: resource allocation, tool for resource allocation, advocacy for communities, and for research.
So this has been going on for, 30 years now almost?
Yes, and that's correct. And it's updated. Well, New Zealand, notwithstanding earthquakes and things, has a 5-yearly census, and the index is updated every time we have a new census.
And what sort of information do you take from the census to update?
What we do is look at the census, and they do change to some extent every 5 years, and we think about which census questions are consistent with our theory of socioeconomic deprivation. So, for example, a brand new question in the 2018 census concerned damp and mouldy housing. And we thought, yeah, that's entirely consistent with our theorisation of socioeconomic deprivation. So we plugged that into our modelling, and it came out as a good variable. So that's now in the index. And in fact, one variable dropped out of the index because the social meaning of the variables changes over time. So the one which dropped out was not having a car. It's lost its social meaning, and it's possibly easier to explain that in terms of the first index, based on the 1991 census, had no phone. There was a no phone variable. Houses which didn't have a phone, referring to landlines. Now, that was just at the beginning of the whole cell phone thing. So the whole meaning of not having a phone at home changed so radically that that variable was dropped out in subsequent versions of the index. Now the most important variable in that domain is no access to the internet at home. Because
right.
In terms of structures of opportunity, actually, the internet is now an absolutely crucial tool for doing so many things.
Before, I suppose, getting on to the damp and mouldy housing, I just want to, I guess, touch on when this comes out, when you guys look at the census and then you release the latest version of the index, I suppose, who kind of takes this on, or is this used by the government or that sort of thing?
Yeah. So it's used, for example, in the major funding formulas for district health boards and also aspects of funding for primary health organisations. So government uses it to direct resources into areas of highest need. So what that means in practice is that for a district health board which has a large number of its population who live in areas of relative poverty relative to the rest of the country, they get more money because poverty and poor health go together. They're bolted onto each other. So you can safely predict that an area which has more low-income families and it has higher health needs, and therefore that district health board gets more money.
So with damp and mouldy housing being a new measure in the latest index, so can we start by saying why is that an issue now? Why has that become the latest measure now? Because I think, well, my understanding of this issue is it's not a new issue.
I think you're quite correct in that. It's not a new issue. The reason that it's in the index now is because it's a new question in the census in 2018. We hadn't had that question asked before.
And in terms of measuring this, so how do we understand what a damp or mouldy house is? Is there a kind of spectrum, or is it just anything which could possibly pose danger to anybody living in that house?
No, and I'd have to check to give you the exact wording of the census question, and I forget what it is. I think it's compared areas of mold the size of an A4 sheet of paper or something like that, but I can't remember the exact wording. So it was quite specific in the way it asked about damp housing.
And your sentence from the release, I suppose, is that living in a damp, mouldy house is equivalent to taking your children home where it is raining on the inside, and this places you and your children at risk of respiratory diseases. Could you just speak to some of the effects, I suppose, of living in those homes?
Yes, sure. And look, and just to note, there's been a lot of very, very high-quality research on this topic carried out by other people in New Zealand and other researchers. So the consequences of not having a warm, dry home are numerous. I mean, it is a fundamental for healthy living, and it's not just respiratory diseases which affect people who live in damp or mouldy houses. It's also allergic conditions and, of course, psychological well-being. There's an array of problems which arise from damp and mouldy housing, and those problems are particularly important for the young, the very young, and the elderly, but they actually affect everybody as well. So hospitalisation rates are higher for people in damp, mouldy housing, for example, for children.
So what might we see over the next few years, or at least until the next census, and perhaps health, I guess, or how, like you say, finances can be allocated in that way? What might we see because of this change in the index?
Well, on the housing front, the government has quite rightly put a huge emphasis on affordable, warm, dry housing, particularly for people on lower incomes. So that has been picked up, and it's sort of a major policy direction already. In terms of the way that the index functions, it's been a tool which has been used by government and by communities and by researchers for a very long period of time. It will continue to be used in that way. So what changes this time round is that it's now updated and it can be used for 5 years. The background patterns are pretty stable, so they don't change a lot within a five-year period. And what it means is that its original functions for particularly resource allocation and also advocacy can be carried out with confidence because it's the updated version. Also, things do change. So areas which have been gentrified over a 5 or 10 year period, or areas which have had the opposite of gentrification, ghettoisation or marginalisation, their ranking in the scale will change. You know, there are real changes in terms of the amount of resources going into areas, depending on how they compare with other parts of the country.
Is there anything else you wanted to add, Peter?
I think, having worked on this for, as you say, around 30 years, or not quite, 28 years or something like that, what strikes me about all of this is how deeply structured in poverty is in New Zealand. Now, you don't need the index to tell you that, but it does just highlight that point. And I don't find that an acceptable way to run a society or a country. So that's just a personal value that I have. And I will never, ever, if you ask me that sort of question, never, ever miss the opportunity to say that we can be doing better from a social and economic policy point of view as a country, so that so many whānau, communities, individuals are not living in poverty. It's not necessary. It's something that we create as a society, and we can choose to do things differently if we want.
And I think that's a point well made, in the sense of you're saying this is not an acceptable way to run a society, but also why is it that we also, I guess, as a society, find it acceptable to live in these conditions? Or is it more that we are constrained by the fact that if, you know, sure, there are now regulations in place for insulation and soon to come heat pumps and that sort of thing, but if we as tenants even question, you know, there's the risk of us being kicked out?
Hmm. Yeah, well, there's a long history which have led to the state of affairs, and in fact, the capital gains tax, or absence of one, is part of that whole complex picture, because, of course, it drives property investment and, as I say, is part of the picture. Why do we tolerate it? Well, that's a very good question. I mean, a lot of people who live in damp and mouldy houses, of course, would feel they've got absolutely no choice about that in the way that you just described. I mean, it's hard to complain often. And if you've got a house, you're luckier than somebody who doesn't have a house. In the end, it's who has voice and power in society. And so long as we, as a society, tolerate that, we will continue to have those conditions. And I'm suggesting that then it's not a tolerable situation. And a lot of what I'm saying is now sort of mainstream. And this government, for example, has really launched a major set of policies around improving the housing stock. But that, of course, will take time.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.